In the dark and dense night you cast your benign eyes upon me. Take me and make me your very own, offering your compassion. I am your innocent child. Alone do I walk on a thick, dense path. With your two arms, embrace me. Allow me not to be drowned and washed away by the turbulent currents of life. Sri Chinmoy. Chapter 9. Learning to Live. In my glee, I did not see the final hurdle and collided with it quite inelegantly. To reach the finish line of becoming Sri Chinmoy's disciple, I would be required to make a few changes in my worldly habits. Purifying and simplifying my outer life would apparently help me to meditate. It meant avoiding any substances that would harm, agitate, or dull the so-called subtle nerves necessary for meditation. It also meant avoiding the main source of emotional turbulence known to humankind, seeking a partner. All this sounded logical, but these were not only practical changes, they were a way of honouring and sanctifying my commitment to the inner life, just as a monk or nun would take vows on entering an order. Specifically, I would need to follow a vegetarian diet, abstain from drugs and tobacco, abstain from alcohol, and, as I was yet unmarried, remain single. The first two requirements I had already chosen for my own reasons, and the third at least made sense to me. My inner guide had stopped visiting me as he used to, even after my excesses. Perhaps because I had finally found him in the outer world, his presence on my private patch of inner coastline was no longer necessary. Although meditation came spontaneously if I was sober, it hid or ran off like a deer if I had indulged even mildly, and often my indulgence was far from moderate. I would perhaps not give up the vice of drink immediately, but I could see the reason for trying. Some part of me balked entirely at the fourth requirement. Tom was pretty much out of the picture, so I already considered myself single for the time being, and I had also run far from the idea of bearing offspring. Still, I declared openly that I was definitely not ready for such a holy life, and would certainly not be ready for the duration of this lifetime. That level of commitment was for other people, people with a clear divine calling, not me. I tried to cover the tracks of my own spiritual experiences to date, denying their existence altogether. It was easy to do at first because nobody else knew about them. To others, I decided to claim only some vague leaning towards meditation. It was surely just a hobby for me, and did not need to be a way of life. Surely I would need to marry at some point. Who was I to think of becoming the direct disciple of such a lofty spiritual master anyway, especially having led a relatively coarse existence until then? There was no escaping the truth for long, though. In my heart the decision had already been made, perhaps as I spun in slow motion on the M5, or maybe before I even entered the world. It just took a little while to filter through to all the other parts of my being. I could not pretend meditation was unimportant to me, not after all I had jettisoned in the quest for truth. The problem came down to the fierce aversion to aloneness that had followed me from birth. I assumed being single would mean being solitary. I could simply not imagine solitude and happiness living in the same sentence. I pictured myself then as a fledgling on the edge of a nest I had obviously outgrown, but not daring to jump in case my own wings failed me. Leaving that nest went against an instinct of survival, and yet, for one who is born to fly, it is the only route to that same survival. There was no point wishing one was born a toad or an antelope or some other ground-dwelling creature if that was obviously not God's intention. It was something I had only read about, but I knew it then for sure. There can be two very powerful competing instincts from two levels in one tiny self. Such is the guile of God's game. At last, in that light, I saw my resistance as no more than a fear. Since first practicing meditation, my policy with fears had been to go after them and stamp them out, or at least shake my fist at them before running away. Having stared even death in the face on the motorway, I had felt more alive, but I knew very well that living was not some linear, predictable process, complete with a reliable set of instructions. All the props and crutches of comfort or seeming necessity had been stripped away on my return from Thailand. After the resulting shock, on some fundamental level, I was already clearer and stronger for having faced so many fears at once. Logically, I was sure even then that a job or a relationship, any material possession or social position, did not define me. That my sense of self lived on even in their absence had formed further proof, categorical evidence for my inner detective. Although devastating at the time, the turning point on the metal bridge had been a crucial part of my journey. I did not know then, but such complete desolation and annihilation of identity has been a common course for many who have gone before me, across the ages and myriad routes to the one same goal of spirituality. Some call it the long dark night of the soul. It is also said that when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Apparently I was ready. Nothing and nobody else stood in my way. Nobody else could make those steps for me either, but someone was already leading me through the darkness. It was like crossing a frail bridge of rope that shook and swayed in the wind, but linked my route to a higher peak. I trembled at the long, empty space beneath it, but some lasting ounce of faith bid me walk across. Beyond it, the ground was already firmer than anywhere I had ever stepped. It took only 2 days to reconcile myself, but a lifetime seemed compressed inside those hours. I pictured Nanny holding out the seam of her wedding dress with a hand like porcelain. I saw her stumbling then, half carried from her husband's wake to end her own days without him. I pictured my mother on her own wedding day in 60s satin and a neat little waist, my father in a laddish smile and sideburns. 9 years later, either he was gone or we were. From any angle, the result was the same. We each had to start again. I saw James fading from me behind imagined snow and felt the cool space in my heart where he used to be. If even he was not enough, who could be? No, I could not expect anyone outside myself to give me happiness. Not the real sort that would stand up to weathering. Only God had access to products of such quality. I allowed my mind the comfort of knowing I could change my course after a day or a year. If in future I suddenly felt sure a man was more likely to keep his promises of happiness than spirituality, I could go back the way I came. What I could not live with was turning away at the start, having never even tried. It seemed even to my mind a practical way to lead a spiritual life. I would still have a home and a job, but would support it all with inner strength and a constant awareness of the divine. It was the first time I had made a clear decision about my life without any influence from friends or family. As my parents had always intended, my spiritual choices were to be made only by myself. I rummaged in all the best stationery shops for the right pen and paper, but what instruments could possibly fit the task of writing to a spiritual master? I traipsed through a forest of doubts about my handwriting or my choice of words, but then decided I must be myself, as he would see through any charade. I simply chose what I liked best, a card with a photograph of autumn leaves in all the possible colours, like the ones my childhood self had found under a maple tree. How could that be wrong? It's God's art, not mine, I decided. As my inner guide, maybe he would like the same things as I did anyway. I had a picture taken in a booth near work, in black and white instead of colour. If I liked meditating on his black and white picture more than the colour one, maybe he would have the same preference. The collar of my black wool skirt suit showed a little at my neck. I had tidied my hair in long straight layers and wore a little less makeup than usual. The damp strip dropped out of the machine, revealing four wistful copies of me, each with a barely perceptible smile. On New Year's Eve, I drank like a sailor, vowing then never to touch another drop. In the groggy aftermath, I felt sure to keep my promise at last. The one remaining task was to tell Tom, but I thought he would not be interested, having already drifted so far from my world. First he mocked me, but then he showed a jealous sort of curiosity, so I suggested he join the next set of classes at Clifton Library. To my surprise, he went, but did not return after the first night, and would not talk about it. That was that, or so I thought. It was then that Tom fell apart. He had imagined all along I would be there if he finally decided to make a space for me in his life, but I was no longer tethered to his whims. It was clear to me that we must go our own ways, but drugs had further eroded his mind, so for him things were far more complicated. Although I thought I was only a tiny part of his life, to him I was a linchpin steadying the crooked wheel of his emotions. According to Tom, removing myself was to let him tumble. My old familiar need to be needed opened one eye at the whistle's call, but did not rouse itself to follow. Even before, when things were much simpler, I had not been enough for him, and I certainly had neither the strength nor compulsion to carry him out of that deepening mire. I could only pull myself away, or sink into it with him. Either way, I was powerless to help. Tom inevitably blamed me for the collapse that followed, and even had me worry for his life. Eventually he admitted he needed more help than I could give, and at last he felt bereft enough to seek it. His parents took him into their care in Wales. The doctors gave him strong prescriptions and a regimen of counselling. Knowing he was in safe hands, I closed the door at last. The echoes rang out for a while, but it never blew open again. Tom had apparently played his role in my life's drama, and I had played my role in his. Via some roundabout route, we had actually brought each other to where we needed to be. He had lured me back from Asia, on false or imagined promises, by a power much stranger than love. Had I been left with more than just myself to depend on, I would not have longed so keenly for my true inner home. In turn, by removing myself from Tom's world, I left him to seek his own apt refuge. We were each a part of the other's journey, but neither of us could have been the destination. The centre leader received a call from New York late on the night of February 14th to say that Sri Chinmoy had accepted me as his disciple. I was due at the cafe the next morning, so I heard it from her then. At the time I felt just as before, and was not duly surprised at the news, but more relieved to know my convictions had not been illusions. I had waited several weeks for a response, which apparently was not unusual, but to me the date of that outer confirmation could not have been more perfect. St. Valentine's Day. It may have been coincidence, but I chose to take it as a sign of recognition from God that I had accepted the challenge of a single life, and as a secret promise that the spiritual life would outweigh the charms of any earthly romance. Two of us applied and were accepted at around the same time. The second was a Spanish girl studying at university. She was light and wiry, like a butterfly, but left a whirlwind of chaos and laughter wherever she went. Everyone loved her, mostly because she loved everyone, but we became especial friends due to our similar circumstances. We too would meet at the proper centre from then, on our own particular nights for a while, so as to get used to things before joining the official meetings. The centre was a converted front room in a house shared by some of the boys. Sri Chinmoy regarded all his male disciples as boys, no matter their age, and the females as girls. To him, age was largely in the mind. By dwelling on our increase in years, we only limit ourselves and squander our enthusiasm. By thinking of ourselves inwardly as 7 years old, no matter our earthly age or responsibilities, we can retain our youthful happiness and freshness. I liked the idea very much, but childhood felt yet more serious to me than adulthood. My 7-year-old memories were especially grave, mostly revolving around loss and the resulting grief, so they would take some unlearning. The spontaneity of my new Spanish companion gave me hope that my own somberness might wear off in time, but I would not want all her caprice. I hoped still to carry my sensible and dutiful qualities, but perhaps just in a lighter item of luggage. It was only when I reached home after hearing the news of my acceptance that I felt its impact. Somehow Alison's chattering and the avocado bathroom were more of a hindrance than ever to the life of quietude and purity I had entered inside myself. I realised I would need to do all I could to maintain a sense of sacredness in my outer life, regardless of whether the people around me understood or valued the same things as I did. Although mastering the 4 requirements was a good start, my spiritual self felt like a new flower that needed safeguarding against the winds of the world. Admittedly, leading a spiritual life within the secular would be more comfortable in some ways than the cloistered choice of a traditional nun, but in other ways it would be more challenging. I would be immersed in daily disturbance, distraction, and temptation. Nobody asked me to do it. I just thought life would be simpler if I drew a line between my old priorities and my new ones. My fingernails were the first to go. They had always grown easily, so I had kept them long and painted them carefully in the style of a French manicure. I knew I was vain about them, so keeping them would only invite the sort of attention I no longer wanted. To me, cutting them was akin to shaving my head. My hands felt bare and short, like a child's at first, but I soon welcomed the use of my fingertips after so many years, especially for typing at work, or for fiddly things like threading a needle. The eyeliner went the same way as the nail varnish, and so did the lipstick. Photographs of Tom and others from my murkier past followed them all into the bin soon after. There was no sadness at all, only relief. My inner luggage was already easier to carry. On the night of the art class, I had seen a book by Sri Chinmoy called Colour Kingdom, containing his spiritual interpretations of various colours. I was fascinated by all of them and surprised by some, but his views on the colour black I could almost have predicted myself. It apparently represented inconscience. As I was hoping to become more conscious by practicing meditation, wrapping myself in such a void would only add to the challenge. Although I naturally associated it with death and darkness, I had worn a lot of black since school because it goes with everything. Then almost everything ended up being black, and there was not much else to go with it anyway, so it may as well have been mint green for all the sense that made. I certainly felt less sombre when I wore my blue suit to work instead of my black ones, so it was not only book knowledge. There was soon a pile of black things for the charity shop, and a few other things that were admittedly flirtatious. I went shopping for happier colours instead, and chose more modest necklines than I would have done before. It seemed years had been shed from my age when only that was done. The last and most complicated choices concerned my music. I knew that apart from spirituality, music affected me more deeply than anything, so I could not hope to prize my emotions from it, nor would I wish to. After listening to a few albums I was not sure about, I decided to keep anything classical because it seemed timeless, and a lot of it was obviously more divine than earthly. One boxed set seemed to form a border of the two worlds, a collection of anonymous pilgrim songs. They were ostensibly songs for God, but some were deliberately written in a bawdy drinking style so as to make conversion more palatable for the masses. With a smile of irony, I decided it fitted me rather too well to let it go. The rest had too many recent memories hidden in them, most of which were sad or strange. I sealed the tapes and discs of that sort in a bubbled envelope and gave them to my brother, knowing that way I could borrow them back if I missed them. I had already explained briefly to him and to my mother the changes I was making, but my family was used to me reinventing myself, and probably assumed the spiritual life was another fad, like songwriting or scuba diving. I was fairly sure it was more than that, but after trying out so many versions of myself, even I would have to wait and see before being certain. The centre room felt full of warmth and welcome, but looked like a clear pool in a snowscape. Until then I would have assumed two such very different impressions could not live together in the same place, but they were perfectly in balance there. The carpet was lavishly soft and powder blue as though reflecting the sky. The walls and ceiling were brilliant white, further brightened by ambient lighting. A transcendental picture, much bigger than any I had seen, looked in from the bay of the window on a low white table, making a sort of shrine area. It was set with a long white candle on one side, and on the other a gentle profusion of yellow roses in a bowl. The room itself was otherwise empty, apart from some neat stacks of cushions at the back, some well-ordered shelves of books, a modest stereo, and the scent of jasmine. The rest was apparently to be found within. The Spanish girl and I arrived early for our first lesson in wearing a sari. My mind resisted, and I said so. Although I thought it slightly odd, I was not so averse to seeing it on other Europeans, but wearing it myself was a different matter. I had no outer connection to India and had not even been there, so flouncing about in Indian garb felt fraudulent. It was explained that having a special set of clothing for meditation was like having a special area in one's house for that purpose. Just another way of creating sanctity, in turn making meditation easier and more enriching. The boys thus wore pure white trousers and shirt. The girls wore a sari of any design or colour except black. It would take me a while to grow into the theory and a while longer to claim it as my own, but I agreed at least to try one on. My companion had no such qualms. To her everything was a game, so her life was in many ways more straightforward. We were shown into a back room overlooking the yard. My new artist friend, who gave the painting class, had sent two saris for me from her own collection. That kindness itself further softened my resistance. After a few failed attempts, stabbing myself with safety pins, twirling one time too many, or wrapping the wrong shoulder, I eventually mustered enough stubbornness to fold mine in place, although not to my own self-imposed standards. The other girl was chattering and flitting about so much she practically had to have hers put on for her, but she looked dainty when it was done, even more like a butterfly. I felt quite regal in mine, and looked much smarter in the mirror than I thought I would, but such comments were kept to myself in case they sounded immodest. Already saris were growing on me. Rather than acting like a uniform, they seemed to accentuate different qualities in each person. The meeting itself consisted of familiar musical and meditative ingredients from our evenings at the cafe, but each felt magnified by the purity and sanctity of that room. At the end, bowls of tangerines, iced biscuits, and squares of chocolate were placed at the front as prasad, blessed food. The word was unfamiliar, but the custom I recognised fondly from the little dusty chapel in Mexico. Two envelopes were then put on the low table. To my tearful relief, they contained transcendental pictures for us each to take home. Around that time I had a problem I could not seem to solve, either by talking to others or through my meditation. I do not remember what it was, but I do remember someone suggested writing it in a letter to Sri Chinmoy, not to send, but just to leave in front of my transcendental picture at home. I imagined I would have quite a few problems throughout the rest of my life, So rather pessimistically, I bought a heavy spiral-bound notebook for the purpose, intending to leave it open at the appropriate page as I went along. I sat down to meditate, then wrote this first problem down. As it was a complicated one, the letter went on to three sides, so I carefully laid the book open at the first page, meditated again, and left the room. Then I wondered when the letter would be read. Would it take moments, days, weeks? I went back again, vaguely hoping to sense an answer to that simpler question, to discover the first page had turned over to reveal the second and third. The window was not open, so it could not have been a draft, and it is not in the nature of heavy spiral-bound notebooks to do anything other than lay down flat. I took that to mean not moments, days, or weeks, but now. Whatever the problem, and however it is presented, as long as the solution is sincerely sought. Each month or so, all the British centres would gather in one city or another over a weekend for joy days, where we would meditate together, eat together, run together, and entertain one another with musical or humorous acts. There were games, too, and a great deal of prasad. It was at the cafe that I met the members of my extended spiritual family for the first time. The room bustled with more visitors than it could reasonably hold, so some spilled into the stairwell or stood in mirthful bunches chatting and chuckling, munching on bright salads and home-baked lasagna. We two newcomers were paraded about like twin princesses, pampered with smiles and female attention. I needed a notebook for writing down new people. Many were known by spiritual names bestowed on them by Sri Chinmoy. The names were beguiling and beautiful, and had yet more beautiful meanings. But I was as though back in my infancy, frowning and listening long before daring to try the new, exotic words for myself. By chance I settled at a table with a pianist who had her own music group called Temple Song Hearts. My artist friend sang in the group and had given me recordings, so I had heard much of their repertoire already and was very taken by it. Although all the songs were by Sri Chinmoy, each had its own distinct atmosphere and personality. Some were pensive and delicate, reminiscent of a lone longing. Others were floods of bracing power. Others were quickening canons whose playfulness had me clapping along with joy. I was suddenly shy in the company of one so gifted, even though apparently there was plenty to say. "Keep your eye on this one," said the centre leader as she passed, raising an eyebrow in my direction, although she was hardly visible under a huge basket of bread. "She's got a voice and an ear." I was not entirely sure what she meant, but the pianist eyed me more seriously then and quizzed me about my singing experience. I mumbled through it as briefly as possible, quite certain she would not be interested in my music career once she knew how short and unwholesome it had been. Soon after, most of the centre flew to celebrations in New York. For the anniversary of his arrival in the West every April and his birthday every August, Sri Chinmoy's disciples from all over the world went to meditate with him in person. Two or three from Bristol could not afford the airfare that time and stayed behind to staff the cafe. The rest of us would need to wait until we had been in the centre for a year before we could go, and we all wanted to help keep the cafe open too. It was my first encounter with selfless service in the centre, serving others without expecting any benefit in return, other than the enjoyment of giving. Sadly, my waitressing skills had not miraculously improved in line with my fitness. However keen I was to be of use, I was still a menace, in the kitchen or at the tables. I was thanked politely for my efforts, but was only ever invited back as a customer rather than a worker. The only thing I could be trusted with was washing up, but there were always ample volunteers for that. I discovered it had been Sri Chinmoy's favourite job at the ashram, the spiritual community where he grew up. The simple activity left his mind free so he could easily meditate at the same time. My brother came to stay for a weekend in May so he could keep me company at the half marathon. Keeping me company was a loose term. We both knew he would finish in half my time, but it was a comfort to know he would be covering the same ground. Still determined to hate running, my road training had been somewhat slapdash, My lungs and heart rose willingly to the occasion, but apparently running needed quite different muscles from the ones I used in gym training, so my legs were buckling by 10 miles. I was too proud to walk in a race, so I sort of hobbled and convinced myself it still counted. A stream of stragglers passed me until even the walkers outstripped me one by one. I gave them a knowing grimace or a weak flap of the hand as they passed. The portway was usually a busy entrance to the city. A section nearest the river had been closed for the race, but opened again after 2 hours, not to traffic, but to something far less predictable. There was a complete fairground with rides and dodgems, clowns and coconut shies. Changing tack even slightly was more discomfort and complication than I thought I could handle by then, but I was suddenly like a character in some bizarre computer game, weaving in and out of bumbling families and clumps of teenagers with cuddly toys and pet dogs and hot dogs and cold drinks and candy floss. I felt I had run the length of the country by the time I reached the city again, but had to admit nothing could replace the feeling of crossing that finish line. Despite my initial reluctance and the protestations of my legs, I had caught the running bug. I was nervous before my first proper centre meeting, which was silly since the programme, the place and most of the people were very familiar by then, and since it was supposed to be more about the interior world than the outer one anyway. Those I had not met lavished the two of us with kindness, and everyone had bought us gifts. Apart from the room being fuller than before, and the silent meditation being a little longer, it all seemed the same at first, but a new challenge was about to present itself. Although I was already of a somewhat restless nature, on our own separate evenings everyone seemed fidgety to some extent, so I was not so conspicuous if I was having a fidgety day. I proudly imagined I could sit still for half an hour of silent meditation if I set my mind to it, but in practice it was not so simple. One leg felt like there was something sizable crawling inside it, and I yearned with all my being to wiggle it. The same problem had arisen in the past while watching films, but nobody minds or even notices then. Knowing I had to be still made it infinitely harder to do so. My concern not to disturb people was equalled by my fervent desire not to make a bad impression. It was more an exercise in endurance than meditation. I held my breath and felt prickles of sweat growing in my eyebrows. I tried guessing the time and counting out what I thought were blocks of 60 seconds. I tried tightening the muscles discreetly under my sari. Nothing helped. Ironically, nothing except the chant of Om, signifying the end of the meditation. It happened more often than not after that, but I did not say anything, and there was nothing I could do. I tried all sorts of potions and postures and pills at home, but to no avail. Although meditation was almost impossible at fidgety times, I still felt almost the same afterwards as I did after a good meditation, just by being there with others, singing, reading, and making a sincere attempt to be still. The benefits increasingly outweighed the discomfort, and the discomfort itself gradually abated for the most part. Even on the seemingly unbearable days, I realised there was nowhere in the world I would rather be than in that room, and I always longed for my next visit.